From Toronto, it's time for your weekly dose of conservation information here on Canada's All Environmental News Hour. On behalf of CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and our fantastic community radio partners across the country, I'm Darren Kaster, and welcome to the Green Majority. This week, first we'll be hearing from Van Jones, who's going to be talking about plastic and its relationship to oil. But specifically, Van Jones is going to be telling us how plastic bottles actually hurt the poor. So we're taking a real bit of a side chance, but that's no surprise from Van Jones. He's always making those cross connections. Of course, a big hero for the environment, especially definitely in the U.S. Particularly in the second half. However, we're going to be moving back to my personal current hobby horse, Bill C-38. Will be joined by, at the very least, Tyler Irving. Possibly we may have a surprise guest or two joining us as well. But we'll be dealing with Bill C-38. We first had a report last week with Richard Lundgren from the Canadian Environmental Law Association about the first casualty. Tyler's going to do some reality check on some information here. He went and was digging through those archives, so we'll be getting right into the meat of that, because as of yesterday, the most recent headline was that we're now up to 3,000 casualties in less than 2 weeks. So stay tuned for that as well. But however, we're going to start the show off with Leah Mazzolini, who's got some international headlines.
Thanks, Darren. Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney says his plan to make American energy independent by 2020, including making Keystone XL pipeline, a go. His announcement was made on Thursday, August 23rd, at a speech in New Mexico. His goal is to get the 1,900-kilometer pipeline to bring crude oil from Alberta's oil sands to the U.S. Gulf Coast as soon as possible. Keystone's construction was halted late last year due to an overwhelming backlash from environmentalists, civilians, and even celebrities. However, many supporters claim the economic benefits outweigh the potential environmental risks associated with the project. Romney also mentioned that he wants to establish an energy partnership with Canada and Mexico, further saying that he wants to fast-track the process to make sure that infrastructure projects are approved. In addition to Keystone, Romney sets his eyes on lifting the ban on mid-Atlantic offshore drilling and toots his entire energy plan will create 3 million jobs and more than $1 trillion in profit. A new disconcerting report released on Tuesday, August 21st, reveals that the U.S. is throwing away more than they can chew. According to the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NDRC, a non-partisan environmental advocacy group, America is dumping 40% of the world's food supply, with a price tag of about $165 billion U.S. annually. NRDC scientist Dana Gunder says that even if the entire agriculture sector was fully sustainable, it would be futile against the mounting waste of uneaten food. The report further explains that since 1970s, the food wastage has skyrocketed to 50%, making it the largest element of solid waste in U.S. landfills. Factors such as unsold produce in supermarket and large portion prepared food are major contributors. The NRDC says that U.S. government should conduct an in-depth study of losses in the food system. Businesses should streamline their inventories, and consumers should be more mindful of their buying habits. A new global fund of climate change aims to aid poorer countries. The UN has held its first conference of its Green Climate Fund on Thursday, August 23rd. The fund consists of about $1 billion that wealthy nations have put forth to help developing nations slash CO2 emissions and adapt to climate change conditions. It also states that it was created as part of a deal made last December 2011 at the Durban Climate Talks in South Africa. The money will be distributed each year until 2020. However, some developing countries want to limit the fund so that contributions from the public sector only come from traditional donors. This means that countries labeled as developed in the original UN climate treaties of 1992 and the Kyoto Protocol of 1997. Yet wealthy nations, including the US and the UK, insist that this distinction should not apply to the fund. And that's all for the international news. I'm Leah Mazzolini.
Thank you very much, Leah. We'll be hearing from Van Jones on how plastic bottles hurt the poor right after this music break.
Listen up, Sonny. There'll be some big changes in the next little bit, you see? Some people got big plans. Little men, big men, medium-sized men and women. They got agendas to take place with or without you. So look alive. Things is heating up like corned beef hash. Yes, a primrose path, the aftermath of the blast. Backlashing mankind's acts, major players to play. They scream no salary caps. Big hands and small cookie jars that bust up the glass. Stat thirsty, so reluctant to pass. And y'all know that style of play, it's quite disgusting in fact. Got you reluctant to know, want you reluctant to ask. Now that's attachment to detachment, that's a tough one to grasp. So dig it. Yourself in a celebrity setting, and you fancy the idea of a celebrity wedding. Set free and debt free from the delicate spending, a far cry from what you're usually getting. These mercenary boats just try and keep your head afloat, so the weight don't fill your throat and have you choking like it's resin smoke. It's corporate welfare firms is lining up like ghetto folk. They're walking in with envelopes, they left repressors metal ropes. Eight guns and ammo, crack cocaine, dismantle. If it's more than you can handle, then just go change the channel. Sitcoms, high heels, Botox and chemical peels. Meanwhile, they quit fast passing bills up on Capitol Hill. You see the pictures depict the victims mistaken for villains. They found women and children when killing fields got a trimming. A foreign aid charade, no more embargoes on trade. Cause now the cargo on a sway can stamp USA made. Because they played them. And nobody be talking cause they too busy shopping. Everybody be driving cause they can't stand walking. And they name brand dropping, get the mortgage rates locked in. Hey, these are the things that you see quite often. Cause now people see but know they don't give a damn. Unless it involves the assets, freedom or immediate fame. Yo, a last ditch effort, force expedient plans. And peace of mind passed up for piece of ass and piece of land. Just throw your hands up if you like taking a stand. We're like sheep and we gon' silence these lands. I'm just an advocate living on some Indian land. And I would go it alone if I can't get a helping hand. See, revolutions won't be televised. Get wise and understand. Download the video, call out the digital can. The revolution won't be televised. You understand, you'll download that video, call out the digital can. Signing out, leaving you with peace of mind. Don't be afraid to shine. Don't be afraid to whine. In fact, better yet, just don't be afraid at all.
Right, and welcome back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. You can find us online most of the time at greenmajority.ca. However, we're still down on our website for the time being. So in the meantime, in lieu, why don't you come and say hi to us on our Facebook fan page. That's just Green Majority. You can also stay tuned to all our international and national headline posts. That's at Green Majority on Twitter. You can also go ahead and send me a personal email and tell me what a terrible job or great job you think I'm doing. Either way is fine. I take all criticism, compliments, anything's good. I just like knowing that there's other people on the end of the on the other end of this boom mic, and so you can do that at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. You can also know that TGM is produced live every week at CIUT 89.5 in Toronto here with the hard work and dedication of our team of volunteers. We're broadcasting on at least 17 campus and community radio stations in cities across the country, from Vancouver, BC to St. John's, Newfoundland. And I say approximately because we keep finding out all the time that there's new stations that are carrying us that we didn't actually even know about. So at the very least, there's 17 broadcasting us. You can also download that or listen to it, rather, on channel 826 of the Shaw Direct Satellite Network or channel 946 of the Rogers Digital Channel platform. Those are the feeds for CIUT in general. You can get an audio copy or podcast off the website at greenmajority.ca, even though the site is currently down. You can also search for Green Majority at Radio for All. Yes, Radio for All, that's it. That's where we're posting our shows for the time being, and there will be links on greenmajority.ca for time being as well until we get that back up. And of course, as I said, email, Twitter feed, all sorts of ways to interact with the show. If you're interested in suggesting a feature or just telling us that we do a great job, you can say what a great job Ryan's doing or Leah's doing. Anyone, call in, say hello. Everything, we love hearing from people. It's absolutely fantastic. We're going to go now, however, to Van Jones having an attempted character assassination by Glenn Beck, and getting him thrown out of the Obama government isn't enough to slow this man down. He's an absolute hero. Van Jones on how plastic hurts the poor.
I am honored to be here, and I'm honored to talk about this topic, which I think is of grave importance. We've been talking a lot about the horrific impacts of plastic on the planet and on other species, but plastic hurts people too, especially poor people. And both in the production of plastic, the use of plastic, and the disposal of plastic, the people who have the bullseye on their foreheads are poor people. People got very upset when the BP oil spill happened, for very good reason. People thought about, oh my God, this is terrible, this oil, it's in the water, it's going to destroy the living systems there, people are going to be hurt, this is a terrible thing, that this oil is going to hurt the people in the Gulf. What people don't think about is, what if the oil had made it safely to shore? What if the oil had actually got where it was trying to go? Not only would it have been burned in engines and added to global warming, but there's a place called Cancer Alley. And the reason it's called Cancer Alley is because the petrochemical industry takes that oil and turns it into plastic, and in the process kills people. It shortens the lives of the people who live there in the Gulf. So oil and petrochemicals are not just a problem when there's a spill, there's a problem when there's not. And what we don't often appreciate is the price that poor people pay for us to have these disposable products. The other thing we often don't appreciate is it's not just at the point of production that poor people suffer. Poor people also suffer at the point of use. Those of us who are in a certain income level, we have something called choice. The reason you want to work hard and have a job and not be poor and broke is so you can have choices, economic choices. We actually get a chance to choose not to use products that have dangerous, poisonous plastic in them. Other people who are poor don't have those choices. So low-income people often are the ones who are buying the products that have those dangerous chemicals in them that their children are using. Those are the people who wind up actually ingesting a disproportionate amount of this poisonous plastic and using it. People say, well, they should just buy a different product. Well, the problem with being poor is you don't have those choices. You often have to buy the cheapest products. The cheapest products are often the most dangerous. And if that weren't bad enough, if it wasn't just the production of plastic that's giving people cancer in places like Cancer Alley and shortening lives, and hurting poor kids at the point of use, at the point of disposal, once again, it's poor people who bear the burden. Often, we think we're doing a good thing. You're in your office, and you're drinking your bottle of water, whatever it is, and you think to yourself, hey, I'm going to throw this away. No, I'm going to be virtuous. I'm going to put it in the blue bin, He's like, I put mine in the blue bin. And then and then you look at your colleague, you say, oh, you cretin, you put yours in the white bin. We feel so moral tickle, we feel so good about ourselves. But if we, I'm speaking for myself, not you, but I feel this way often. And, so we kind of have this kind of moral feel-good moment. But if we were to be able to follow that little bottle on its journey, we would be shocked to discover that all too often that bottle is going to be put on a boat. It's going to go all the way across the ocean. at some expense, and it's going to wind up in a developing country, often China. I think in our minds we imagine somebody's going to take the little bottle and say, "Oh, little bottle, you know, we're so happy to see you, little bottle. You've served so well, you know." Give it a little bottle massage, you know, a little bottle medal, you know. And say, "Well, what would you like to do next?" You know, and the little bottle says, "I just don't know." But that's not actually what happens. That bottle winds up getting burned. Recycling of plastic in many developing countries means the incineration of the plastic, the burning of the plastic, which releases incredible toxic chemicals and once again kills people. And so poor people who are making these products in petrochemical centers like Cancer Alley, poor people who are consuming these products disproportionately, and then poor people who even at the tail end of the recycling are having their lives shortened, are all being harmed greatly by this addiction that we have to disposability. Now you think to yourself, I know how you are. You say, "That sure is terrible for those poor people." You know, it's like, it's just awful, those poor people. I hope someone does something to help them. But what we don't understand is, here we are in Los Angeles. We've worked very hard to get the smog reduction happening here in Los Angeles. But guess what? Because they're doing so much dirty production in Asia now, because the environmental laws don't protect the people in Asia now, almost all of the clean air gains and the toxic air gains that we've achieved here in California have been wiped out by dirty air coming over from Asia. Okay? So we all are being hit. We all are being impacted. It's just the poor people get it first and worst. But the dirty production, the burning of toxins, the lack of environmental standards in Asia is actually creating so much dirty air pollution. It's coming across the ocean and has erased our gains here in California. We're back where we were in the 1970s. And so we're on one planet, and we have to be able to get to the root of these problems. Well, the root of this problem, in my view, is the idea of disposability itself. You see, if you understand the link between what we're doing to poison and pollute the planet and what we're doing to poor people, you arrive at a very troubling but also very helpful insight. In order to trash the planet, you have to trash people. But if you create a world where you don't trash people, you can't trash the planet. So it's really now we are at a moment where the coming together of social justice as an idea and ecology as an idea, we finally can now see that they are really, in the end of the day, one idea. And it's the idea that we don't have disposable anything. We don't have disposable resources. We don't have disposable species. And we don't have disposable people either. We don't have a throwaway planet. And we don't have throwaway children. It's all precious. And as we all begin to come back to that basic understanding, new opportunities for action begin to emerge. Biomimicry, which is something that is an emerging science, winds up being a very important social justice idea. For people who are just learning about this stuff, biomimicry means respecting the wisdom of all species. Democracy, by the way, means respecting the wisdom of all people, and we'll get to that. But biomimicry means respecting the wisdom of all species. It turns out, you know, we're pretty clever species. You know, we have this big, you know, cortex or whatever. We're pretty proud of ourselves. But if we want to make something hard, you know, we come up, "I know, you know, I'm going to make a hard substance. I know. I'm going to get, you know, vacuums and furnaces and drag stuff out of the ground and, you know, get things hot and you know, poison and pollute. But I got this hard thing, you know. I'm so clever." You know, you look behind you and there's destruction all around you. But guess what? You're so clever, but you're not as clever as a clam, right? A clamshell's hard. There's no vacuums. There's no big furnaces. There's no poison. There's no pollution. It turns out that our other species has figured out a long time ago how to create many of the things that we need using biological processes that nature knows how to use well. Well, that insight of biomimicry, of our scientists finally realizing that we have as much to learn from other species. I don't mean, you know, taking a mouse and, you know, sticking with stuff. I don't mean learning from that way, you know, abusing the little species. I mean actually respecting them, respecting what they've achieved. That's called biomimicry. And that opens the door to zero waste production, zero pollution production, that we could actually enjoy a high quality of life, a high standard of living, without trashing the planet. Well, that idea of biomimicry, respecting the wisdom of all species, combined with the idea of democracy and social justice, respecting the wisdom and the worth of all people, would give us a different society. We would have a different economy. We would have a green society that Dr. King would be proud of. That should be the goal. And the way that we get there is to first of all recognize that the idea of disposability not only hurts the species we've talked about, but it even corrupts our own society. We're so proud to live here in California. You know, we just had this vote and everybody's like, well, not in our state. You know, I don't know what those other states were doing, but, yeah. You know, just so proud. And, yeah, I'm proud, too. But California, though we lead the world in some of the green stuff, we also, unfortunately, lead the world in some of the gulag stuff. Huh? California has one of the highest incarceration rates of all the 50 states. So we have a moral challenge in this movement. We're passionate about rescuing some dead materials from the landfill, but sometimes not as passionate about rescuing living beings, living people. And I would say that we live in a country, 5% of the world's population, 25% of the greenhouse gases, but also 25% of the world's prisoners. Right? One out of every four people locked up anywhere in the world is locked up right here in the United States. So that is consistent with this idea that disposability is something we believe in. And yet, as a movement that has to broaden its constituency, that has to grow, that has to reach out beyond our natural comfort zone, one of the challenges to the success of this movement of getting rid of things like plastic and helping the economy shift is people look at our movement with some suspicion. And they ask a question, and the question is, how can these people be so passionate? A poor person, a low-income person, somebody in Cancer Alley, somebody in Watts, somebody in Harlem, somebody on an Indian reservation might say to themselves, and rightfully so, how can these people be so passionate about making sure that a plastic bottle has a second chance in life, or an aluminum can has a second chance? And yet, when my child gets in trouble and goes to prison, he doesn't get a second chance. How can this movement be so passionate about saying we don't have throwaway stuff, no throwaway dead materials, and yet accept throwaway lives and throwaway communities like Cancer Alley? And so we now get a chance to be truly proud of this movement. When we take on topics like this, it gives us that extra call to reach out to other movements and to become more inclusive and to grow. And we can finally get out of this crazy dilemma that we've been in. Most of you are good, soft-hearted people. When you're younger, you cared about the whole world, and at some point somebody said you had to pick an issue, right? You had to boil your love down to an issue. Can't love the whole world. You got to work on you got to work on trees, or you got to work on immigration. You got to shrink it down and be about one issue. And really, they fundamentally told you, are you going to hug a tree, or are you going to hug a child? Pick. Are you going to hug a tree? Are you going to hug a child? Pick. Well, when you start working on issues like plastic, you realize that the whole thing is connected. And luckily, most of us are blessed to have two arms. We can hug both. Thank you very much.
All right, we're back, and that was Van Jones with How Plastic Bottles Hurt the Poor. We're going to take another music break, and then we're going to be back. Tyler Irving, former co-director of the Green Majority, now media person extraordinaire, is going to be joining us to talk about Bill C-38, also more than likely, although I don't want to say 100% for sure just yet, but more than likely Mike D'Souza as well, journalist, is going to be joining us to talk about Bill C-38. Same story from last week, but we've got lots more developments, so that'll be coming up right after this music break. Stay tuned.
Please take off your shoes before stepping on mine. Hurt. Please take off your shoes before stepping on mine. Yeah. It's too late, baby.
shoes before stepping on my
We are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I believe. Tyler Irving, are you on the line?
I'm here, Darren.
How you doing, Tyler? How would you like to be introduced other than former director of The Green Majority?
That's good enough for
That's
now,
That's good
Darren.
Enough? All right. So we'll keep your actual allegiances a secret for now. So I got you on today because last week we had Richard Lundgren with the Canadian Environmental Law Association talking about what they and Sierra Club were calling the first casualty of the environmental implications under Conservative Bill C-38. It is also known as the Omnibus Bill to create Jobs, Growth, and Long-Term Prosperity Act, as implemented on April 26, 2012. And so we've got a few things that we wanted to talk about. Also, one of the articles that came out yesterday that we wanted to discuss on Canada.com, of course, was an article by Mike D'Souza, who hopefully will be actually joining us in a few minutes here. But just before we get try and get him on the line, where did you want to start? I mean, there's so much here to digest. Did you want to start with the bill itself or with the D'Souza article?
No. Well, I mean, if Mike's going to be joining us, we'll talk about his article when he gets here. But as you mentioned, you know, both of these things are characterized as sort of the first effects that we're seeing of Bill C-38. And while in the case of what the article was about, which was a number of environmental assessments being canceled, I think that is an accurate characterization, the first effects of Bill C-38. When it comes to this nuclear shipment, which you talked about last week, I think characterizing it as the first effects of Bill C-38 is a little bit of a stretch. And I also think the way that the shipment's been characterized as 1,600 tons of nuclear waste is also a mischaracterization of what's actually going on here.
So we had you on, if I'm not mistaken, it was actually the last time we had you on the program. We were talking about that very issue, and you were explaining how you thought that some of the alarm about moving nuclear material through the Great Lakes system was a bit of a lark. So maybe we'll recap that before Mike joins us. What exactly is the issue with moving that material? You say it's not as much to be concerned about. It shouldn't be concerning people at all.
Well, I think we should just be clear about what it is that we're shipping. So what it is 1,600 tons of steel, which is contaminated with a small amount of radioactive material. Basically, what these things are is steam generators, which are giant kettles, essentially. They're used to boil water, which run steam turbines that generate electricity. The problem is that the water was boiled from heat that came out of a nuclear reaction. And so over the course of many years, the inside of these steam generators, these kettles, has become contaminated with a small amount of radioactive material. So each of these generators is 100 tons, and there's maybe 4 grams or so of radioactive material on the inside of them. So you've got this giant piece of steel, but, you know, it's got some contamination. What do you do? And what Bruce Power, which is the company that owned these generators, is trying to do is what I think is the environmental responsibility thing, which is to recycle them. So we don't have the capacity to do this here, but there is a company in Sweden that can actually melt these things down and separate the radioactive material from just the regular steel. And the regular steel can be recycled, and then the radioactive material can be brought back to Bruce Power, where they have the proper facilities to safely store this stuff. And so, but in order to do this, they need to be shipped across the Great Lakes. And so that's what all of the kerfuffle was about. But of course, that was more or less settled last year. And so the fact that Bill C-38 impacts it is almost a moot point at this point.
Okay, and so what Richard Lundgren was talking about was that they had a court case in I believe federal court, disputing whether or not they could in fact even do that, and so that's specifically what they were referring to about it being done. But yeah, it's a bit of a roundabout issue about how that affects it. It actually affected their court case trying to stop. Saying that there was a legal problem with them being able to do this in the first place, but
yeah, what it actually is anytime you ship nuclear material, and this includes things like medical isotopes that are used for you know medical tests. Mm-hmm. Anytime you ship them, it has to be regulated by the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, which is a group that looks after our nuclear safety as Canadians. And so the Canadian Environmental Law Association and several other environmental groups and First Nations groups and municipalities had appealed to this group and said, do not approve this shipment. And so the commission actually held hearings, and they happened last year, where all these groups, and there were 70 of them in total, were able to have their say and explain why they didn't think that these shipments were safe. And then on the other side, Bruce Power, who's the proponent of the project, was able to explain why they think they did. And, you know, based on what I told you before, the small amount of material, the way that it's protected on the inside of 100 tons of steel, and the extremely low likelihood of an accident, the Safety Commission approved it. So permits were granted. The problem was that, it's not a problem. At that point, Bruce Power decided not to do the shipments because even though they had permission to do it, they wanted to they wanted to make sure that all these people that had objected had a chance to be reassured. But of course, at the same time, these environmental groups launched a challenge, a judicial review of these permits. And so that was underway, trying to overturn this permission. But what's happened in the meantime is that those permits have actually expired. So if Bruce wants to go ahead and ship this stuff, they're going to have to reapply anyway. And so whether or not Bill C-38 has an impact on this is kind of a moot point. Essentially, we're back to square one, and that's the situation that we're at now.
Well, what Richard's point last week was is because they now have to reapply, they'll be able to reapply under the new system, which has more lax laws, I think was his the thrust of his point there. However, if you don't mind, one of the things that I wanted to slide over a little bit. I was letting you know on the phone yesterday that when we were touching base about this, that I had a bit of a rant at the end of last week's show, and one of the issues there was the idea of about you know kind of inside information and certain people getting privileged access to our regulatory bodies and government agencies. And one of the implications there as well is that you said, I mean, this was identified by the Canadian Nuclear Regulatory Association, there have been many accusations in the past that bodies such as that, that are Canadian government bodies or private bodies, you know, that work in partnership with the government, is entirely staffed with ex-lobbyists and current lobbyists for the nuclear industry itself. So when we're talking about things like, I just want to be clear about, you know, very low likelihood of risk and all this sort of thing, is this information that's kind of coming out of the are these simply like public statements that are being put out by bodies like Nuclear Regulatory Industry Association or by the industry itself, or is this just we're talking cold hard science?
Okay, so it's not for me to decide whether someone should believe what the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission says. All I'll say is that there are a large number of very well-trained scientists on the staff of both that body and on the staff of nuclear power, of Bruce Power. I mean, if you're going to run a power plant, you need to have people with the expertise. And based on my read of the science, based on what I've been able to understand is you know, being proposed here, I think the risks are low. You have to keep in mind that, you know, we trust the Nuclear Safety Commission to regulate things, as I said before, like medical isotopes being shipped from various hospitals across the country. And so if we trust them for that, you know, can we trust them for a shipment like this? Again, it's not for me to make the readers decide, but based on, or listeners decide, but based on my read of the science, there's very little to be worried about in this shipment.
Okay. So moving back to a kind of more general standpoint, there was an article on Rabble that was pulled out here, and this is an editorial piece, to be clear, but they were talking about all the 10 reasons not to support this bill, and it talks about various things such as cutting out assessments or consultations with First Nations groups. We have other ones here about how it undermines food sovereignty by amending the seeds and plant breeders' rights. It eliminates a lot of oversight. Now, the point that the government was making was that they were asserting that this would actually help environmental assessment would strengthen environmental protection by removing administrative delay that would hurt the economy. Someone such as myself kind of hears something like that and you know, doing my best to take it at face value, it still sounds like a bit of a contradiction, like military intelligence or something like that, to say that we can strengthen the environment by cutting oversight.
Yeah, so, I mean, this really comes down to this whole issue of how do we balance economic growth and environmental protection? And, you know, what side of that debate, or whether, like me, you believe that it's possible to do both at the same thing, you know, where you fall is really a matter of your opinion. But there is no denying that C-38 has introduced quite a lot of very substantial changes. And you mentioned just like the wide-ranging scope of changes that it's made. It impacts the Species at Risk Act. It impacts the Fisheries Act. It completely replaces the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, and all of these changes sort of tend in the direction of giving the minister responsible, so i.e. the government, much more, I guess we could say, power, or much more of discretion in being able to decide what gets regulated and what we can say, actually, no, that seems fine, we don't need to look at that. And so I would agree that because the changes are so wide-ranging and impact on so many different pieces of legislation, that these changes are quite worrying. And as you say, you know, they were pushed through like a bulldozer, where there was no debate, there was no chance to stop it. And we're now starting to see the consequences of what's happened.
All right. Now, one of the articles we want to talk about came out yesterday by Mike D'Souza, who's a reporter for Post Media News, who wrote an article on this. I actually believe that we have Mike on the line. Are you there, Mike?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. So we've got Tyler Irving. Tyler is a former director of the show as well. And so we were just trying to talk. Well, we might as well start with your article, I suppose. Do you want to maybe just like summarize it for the listeners there if they haven't had a chance to see your article?
Certainly. Yeah. So the new, as I think Tyler was just mentioning, the new Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, which replaced the old one. They scrapped the old one and brought in this new one that changed all the all the requirements. It essentially removed triggers which previously had would force a federal environmental assessment by the agency on a number of projects. And essentially the day after the budget bill was adopted, there were somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3,000 projects that suddenly overnight were no longer requiring an environmental assessment by the agency. It is important to note that there are other forms of review in the whole process. Like, there might be other regulatory bodies such as the National Energy Board that might still be doing an assessment on some of these projects, or another, you know, government body, whether it be like provincial regulatory body, could also be doing an assessment. But there's a certain level of federal oversight that has gone out the window after the passage of Bill C-38.
So last week we were, as I said, I was talking to Richard Lundgren with CELA, and their article that, or the newsletter rather, that Sierra Club and CELA put out was talking about, as we were discussing just at the beginning of the segment here, it was about how this was the first victim. Then a few days later, we've got an article coming out of the Vancouver Sun talking about 500 environmental assessments in BC disappearing, and now we've got you 3,000. One of the issues that that Tyler actually had noticed was that he went to kind of double check your research there. And notice that it's certainly not easy to even find that information. Do you want to talk a little bit about access to this information?
Well, certainly. I mean, it's a database that the agency has just created, and I was noticing yesterday, you know, if you do the right kind of search and you find those 3,000 projects, you can also do it by province, and the Vancouver Sun used the same database to find, I presume they use the same database to find, you know, just the breakdown by province. Yeah, there are a few bugs on their website right now, so if you get the full list and then you try to click on next, suddenly you lose the specific ones, then you end up in a database of everything, of all the projects that have been canceled or archived. So they're working on that. I think they're fixing it, and some of the numbers might be revised. The only way we can know for sure is if we individually check every project. And, you know, there's some that pop up that, you know, would be of interest to people who have been following some of these issues lately, such as a couple of assessments on an Enbridge project to reverse the flow of their Line 9 pipeline. You know, there were assessments that would have been required under the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act previously that now are no longer required, and now it's going straight to the National Energy Board, and some people have raised questions about whether the National Energy Board can do that review as adequately and as thoroughly, you know, cover all the things that the agency would have covered. There's a brand new crude oil terminal that TransCanada wants to build for its original Keystone line in Hardisty, Alberta, northern Alberta. They're building this terminal along with some pipeline infrastructure. Well, at least they're proposing to build it, and this project would have gone through an assessment under the agency, and now it is not. Of course, we presume it would go through other forms of regulatory review, but it's no longer going to be studied by the agency.
There's a couple of key factors here in this story that I want to just run by you, Mike, as well. One of them was part of the conversation we were having with Richard last week was that there's a lot of groups who are kind of framing this as an assault on democracy. So one of the aspects here, just that there were sweeping changes made with very little consultation. Do you think it's too strong for ENGOs to be putting it in that sort of language? Is this some form of an assault on democracy, or is that being a little bit over too much?
Can you rephrase that? I'm not sure I understand exactly.
Can you
give an example? Like what?
Just the idea that such a wide sweeping bill was put through with very little debate and opportunity for Canadians to kind of comment or even really realize what sort of sweeping changes were being made to how the country was run. So Richard Lundgren sort of agreed with me last week that this was in a way a sort of an assault on democracy by removing, both in a big sense with the bill and in a smaller sense with the Bruce Power situation, the 10-minute public consultations that were given, that this is an potentially an outright attempt to simply remove public comment from larger government regulation.
Yeah, so I mean, as a news reporter, I can't comment analyze what this means, what the government did. What I can say is the government is required to review the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act. It has a statutory requirement to do this every 10 years. They were doing this in the fall. They had started to do it before the last federal election under the minority government, but because of other pieces of legislation, it kept getting delayed. And then when it finally got to its review in the fall, the members of Parliament from the government side, from the conservative side, shut down they took action to prevent a full consultative process, and then forced the committee to wrap up its hearings, write a report, and of course they had a majority report that had one view, and then the opposition parties and the minority had a different view about what needed to be changed. So I think that can perhaps feed into the feelings that some have that the review hasn't been thorough or the adequate analysis, whether it has not been done. I mean, people who raise questions about that, they're probably raising very valid questions.
All right. And so, Tyler, if I can go to you perhaps for comment on the same sort of idea here. Do you feel at all like this is removing any form of Canadian citizens' participation in the government at all, or is this, or do you think that this is just really they're just cleaning up some red tape and that really Canadians shouldn't be concerned about this?
There are certainly provisions within the budget bill that now limit the ability of the public to participate in hearings and consultations. If they have to prove they're directly related, they can't. If there's a project that has an impact on the climate, which affects everyone, because they're not in that region, they're suddenly going to be facing restrictions in their ability to participate. So, those are all points that I think people can validly raise and ask about.
And so when you were looking through the government database, then this is the total. You said that, there's still some bugs with the site, and so this isn't necessarily final numbers. What sort of, like you said, as it seems now, about 3,000 reviews have been canceled.
Yeah.
Is that number going to continue to grow? Do you think, is this just kind of the first wave, or what are the long term effects going to be in your opinion?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think one thing I could say, there are a number of projects in there that probably do not merit a full screening or assessment. Some of them might be very, very minor projects, but it's just because there's federal money in it. Like, it could be a project that virtually has no impact on the environment in there. I can't think of an example off the top of my head because I don't have the database.
I can, because I was just looking through it, and
yeah.
there's actually one here which is a hostel in Banff National Park, which has already been there for years, and they're just trying to renew their license. And so I think that might be an example of...
So there are cases like that, and, certainly many people have raised concerns about some unnecessary red tape which is there, which the government was trying to address, and some have said that they're, actually addressing it, though, but using a sledgehammer instead of dealing with the specific problems. But as for whether the numbers will change, I think there could be some. I don't expect any major change, but I don't really know until they've dealt with all the bugs in there. I'm not sure. I can tell you also that the Environment Commissioner, the Federal Environment Commissioner, the watchdog, I think a couple of months ago in June during hearings on the whole Bill C-38, I think he was suggesting that we were going to be going from a situation where there would be 4,000 to 5,000 projects requiring assessment to about somewhere in the neighborhood of a dozen or two dozen. So going from 4,000 to 5,000 to, somewhere between 10 and 30 assessments. So, he has suggested, based on an estimate, that number would be greater. And I think it depends on year to year how many projects are proposed. These are the existing projects that were on the table already that were subject to the review. Now proponents can come forward with other projects knowing that now they're no longer going to be subject to the old provisions of the Act.
Okay, so it's definitely reasonable to say at this point, for especially for people who are feeling a little bit upset about this issue, that at least even of the 3,000 that you outlined in your research, that doesn't necessarily mean that's not like 3,000 new Keystone pipelines. There are potentially several legitimate cancellations of.
There were there's different tools within the database or the search engine that allows you to look at. The types of projects, and I think I had done that search and came up with about, I think it was 248 pipeline cases that had the keyword pipeline in it, and there were, I think it was somewhere around 700 cases that involved fossil fuel energy of some sort. There were cases like involving seismic testing in the Beaufort Sea, in the Atlantic Ocean. You know, some of these are it is legitimate to want to do an assessment on these, where, you know, whereas you might have seismic testing that can disrupt marine life. So there are some substantial cases of concern that are being taken out, along with the small project.
Absolutely. Well, I know you're on limited time, Mike. I really appreciate you taking some time out of your morning to speak to us. I know people can follow you, Mike DeSouza, on Facebook and look at your work on Post Media News as well. Is there any other way that you'd like to let people know to either look at your work or get in touch with you?
Well, certainly, yeah, Canada.com is our main site. I mean, I'm on Twitter, and pretty easy to find through a Google search. So I always welcome any feedback, suggestions, or story ideas, so anyone can reach me anytime.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. And so, Tyler, coming back to you a little bit here. Now, I had a couple of pet peeves. Now, we are very strictly anti-partisan on this show. We don't support. Sometimes we get email or guests that think that we're sponsored by the Green Party of Canada. we're not. We're a politically neutral show. However, I feel like it's within my right a little bit to talk about specific policies. So when we're talking about Prime Minister Stephen Harper, personally made a big case about this sort of tough on crime sort of attitude. And it seems to me that the types of laws in this particular case, he's talking about tough on crime, he's talking about, you know, pickpockets and this sort of thing, and, you know, individual crime, not necessarily petty crime. I mean, that could be including, you know, murder and terrible charges like that, but it's individual crime. Whereas it seems like when we're talking about being tough on crime, well, when it's things that may have been, crime might be a strong word, but when companies are doing things they shouldn't be, or projects they're going to be bad for Canadians in general because they're damaging the environment, well, it's within a government's power to change the regulations such that it's no longer banned or no longer illegal to do those projects. You've always been sort of the voice of reason telling me to sort of calm down sometimes. So am I totally going off the deep end on that? Does it seem like there's a bit of a double standard when it comes to, you don't need to comment on necessarily this particular government's reach here, but there's definitely like a tough on crime sort of stance in many countries. It seems to apply to personal crime, but not to sort of things that corporations are doing and oil companies and this sort of thing. There seems to be a divergent sort of standard.
You definitely took a sharp left turn on me there.
Sorry. Just talking about, the thing that's bugging my brain has been just sort of this idea about, it's not illegal if we change the rules. And I think that's one of the things where I think Mike was pointing out that, yes, there's a significant, potentially significant portion of these reviews are legitimately being removed. Like you said, was a chalet or something in Banff that was just looking to renew its already existing ability to exist, I guess. But that's certainly not all of the cases, and I'm still sort of stuck on that idea of improving the environment while removing regulation. Just strikes me the wrong way, I guess.
Well, I guess all I could really do is encourage people to get informed. I mean, Mike's article on Canada.com has a link right to the database where you can actually see this list that he's drawn up, and you can page through the projects one by one. And the thing that struck me as interesting about it was, you know, a hostel would be put in the same category as an oil pipeline terminal. I mean, whether or not you think that one needs an assessment or the other, the fact that you would even consider those things into the same category sort of strikes me as odd. And so as he was saying this idea that the act was up to be reviewed, I think there's a case to be made that probably there are some changes that need to be made to the act, but then the changes that were made were done sort of quickly and sort of without public comment. without input from other members of Parliament. I don't know. It's worrying and something I would encourage people to get more informed about.
Yeah, I mean, I realize I'm prone to knee-jerk reactions, Tyler, as you've pointed out before. I just sort of got a visual of the idea of the Lorax here for Canada, just because, I mean, we're all this talk about we don't want to hurt Canada's economy while we're protecting the environment, but, I mean, Canada is primarily a resource-based economy. So when we're talking about resources, that is a synonym for the environment in many, many ways. So I guess I'm finding it very difficult to understand how, you know, we can protect economic stability while sort of damaging the thing that we base ourselves on for economic stability. That seems to be just a really contradictory idea that, I mean, if I'm just sort of not getting it and someone wants to write me an email and explain it to me, but...
You're certainly entitled to your opinion, but, you know, as a scientist, I believe that we have a lot of technological knowledge and that if we just leverage what we know, and it is a lot, we can find a way to balance both economic growth and environmental sustainability.
Okay, so you're not in the camp of the sky is falling then, I take it.
Not yet, but just keep a close eye on it.
Okay, so we're going to take a break and wrap up the program, but we're actually about a minute away from the end of the show. So just to recap a little bit, of course, we were talking with we heard from Van Jones this morning, who was talking about the impact of plastic on the poor,
yeah,
and
Darren,
of course,
I had a question for Tyler. Because with Bill C-38, I was curious to know what you feel the impact is. Like, do you feel it's bad? Like, I kind of get the sense that you don't feel it's as bad as people are letting on it is.
I'm not saying one way or the other whether it's a bad thing. I mean, there's change. Certainly it is one of the more important changes to impact environmental legislation in a long time, and for that reason bears close scrutiny, so we need to keep an eye on it.
Right. Okay, cool.
Absolutely. All right, so thanks, Ryan, and thank you, Tyler, as well for joining us. You've been gone for far too long. We'll try and say hello to you again very soon.
Yeah.
And so that is all the time we have for today on The Green Majority. I'm Darren Kaster, of course, your host. Technical production today was by Ryan Knight. Web hosting and bandwidth for the podcast is provided by the web consulting firm rjgcreative.com, with web production by Arlie Crawford. You can get an audio copy of today's program or transcript of our news headlines, as always, at greenmajority.ca. However, currently that is down, so you can get a copy of the program for the time being there. Stay tuned for those headlines. If you have an idea or topic about the show you'd like to suggest, you can email us at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We love hearing from our listeners. However, that has been it for The Green Majority. I'm Darren Kaster, and till next week, thanks for listening.